Thank you for joining us today for another sermon podcast from Flushing Community Church. We desire to experience the transforming love of God and share it with others. It's our hope that you will find today's recording encouraging for your personal journey of faith. Let's join Pastor Terry Bate as he shares another message from God's Word.
Well, last week we began a series that will be in the second week, then we're going to finish it next Sunday. Which, just FYI, gentlemen, is Mother's Day. Just so I give you a little heads-up warning. Hand-delivered my Mother's Day present yesterday. Bonus. Just saying. Check that one off. But last week we started this series called Second Chances. And we started off with asking some real penetrating questions and considering some penetrating statements. What do we do in these moments when God fails to meet our expectations? We asked, what do we do when tragedy strikes, when grief consumes us? How do we handle it when our job is gone, our spouse leaves, our dreams fail to become reality, when life gets harder, not easier? I mean, truly, if God is God, and if He's truly in charge like we preach that He is, then why would He allow these kinds of things to happen to us? It would seem that we could quickly reason that God has failed us, that He's trying to make us miserable if these things take place. Throughout the series, we'll be looking at the life of Joseph, which to me is one of the greatest stories in the Bible. It's a great narrative on so many different levels. And if you're struggling to read the Bible, I encourage you, read the story of Joseph. Genesis 30 to 50 is kind of where that is. This is better than any television show you're going to watch this week on NBC, ABC. It's filled with great plot, with great twists, with evil, with great righteousness. It's got a lot in there, and it's easy to read. It's a story that's not a challenge to try to understand. There's some really, really powerful things here. So I encourage you to read this week. I had a gentleman tell me in the first service that as he's running, training for a half marathon or full marathon, whichever he's doing, he was listening to the Bible and he was listening to Genesis, and he had to stop because he was laughing so hard he couldn't continue to read. Just to understand the plot and what was going on caused him just to step back and go, God, that is absolutely amazing. So I encourage you to read it. Here's the abbreviated Cliff Notes. Cliff Notes are already abbreviated. I'm giving you the abbreviated version of the Cliff Notes this morning on Joseph's life, so you can get a full-scale picture here, because I recognize not everybody has an understanding of who Joseph is. But Joseph is a part of a family that is a powerful family, a wealthy family, and a family that's on a real strategic journey with God. Joseph's family is what we call under covenant, under a contractual promise agreement, promissory note kind of agreement with God himself, that he will bless them as long as they follow him. Joseph is a young man that is born 10th or 11th in the birth line, I believe, of his family of boys, and he is favored by his father, even as being one of the youngest. He is spoiled to death by his mother because he was her firstborn son, and he's wealthy beyond imagination. Joseph has it all. He has it all and then some. And when you read the story, when you understand what's going on here, you can understand and kind of come to a conclusion that while Joseph has it all, he seems like a pretty faithful dude. He seems like a pretty God-honoring guy. So you would think that God would want to honor him and bless him and give him all great gifts. But here's what suddenly happens. His mother dies suddenly. She was giving birth to her second son, and Benjamin, and she dies. So that would be a pretty tragic thing. His brothers hate him; they despise him. We'll see why in just a moment. They throw him into a dry hole in the ground, and they leave him there for quite some time. And before he knows it, when they pull him out of there, he's tied up and chained to a caravan of strangers heading to a land he's never been to. Everything he's ever known, everything he's ever counted on, valued, everything that's ever brought him a sense of safety and security, gone, stripped from him in just moments. At this point last week, as we talked about this story, I asked you to consider, has God failed Joseph? Has God failed Joseph? This person who seemed to have honored God with his life is now experiencing things that don't feel very kind, that don't feel very good. And so we could ask ourselves, has God failed Joseph. Or maybe another way to look at that is God preparing Joseph. I had more than one of you share with me last week that, as we talked about, has God failed us, that it really wasn't a question of if God had failed you. It was a question of what to do when others fail you. That when life circumstances happen, that you don't often struggle with the fact of God failing you, but that what you struggle with is that you see how other people have failed you. And that's exactly what we've come here today to talk about. How do we respond when others hurt us? What do we do when they fail us, when they let us down, when they fail to meet our expectations, or when they just downright seem to have it out for us? These are the questions we need to ponder today. I ask you in your bulletin insert, if you have your bulletin insert, taking some notes or making grocery lists, whichever you use that for, or you're logged into our online YouVersion live event through that app on your phone, I ask you to think about what stands out to you as a moment in your life that someone has wounded you, a moment that someone has failed you, let you down, left you behind. I want you to place those circumstances squarely in your mind today, because as you do, you're going to be listening to the story of Joseph, and I think that as you listen to your circumstances and think about your story, you'll see how there's a great connection here. In Joseph's life, there are several times that people fail him. One, his brothers fail to protect him. Another scene, Potiphar, who is going to be his boss, basically, fails to listen to reason. And a third moment is when the cupbearer, also we would call a butler, they meet each other and fails to keep a promise. We're going to look at these three stories today, these three scenes from the greater story of Joseph. So the first scene is this. Joseph is sold to a group of men by his brothers. Now, let's set the stage of really what's going on here. The best way to do this is to look at these words from Genesis 37. This tells the tale of how Joseph got himself in this position. When Joseph was 17 years old, he often tended his father's flocks. He worked with his half-brothers, the sons of his father's wife, Bilhah and Zilpah. But Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things his brothers were doing. Maybe not such a great plan, all right? Just saying. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So one day, Jacob had a special gift made just for Joseph. It was a beautiful robe. But his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They couldn't say a kind word to him. So we've got this 17-year-old, tattletale, spoiled, rotten teenager. He's on a collision course, right? He is on a real collision course with something that is not going to go right. And because they hated him, because their brothers couldn't even say a kind word to him, they kind of developed a strong set of emotions regarding him. And maybe they had right to feel this way. But one day they're out tending the flocks, and they're far away from home, and they see Joseph and his pretty little coat coming up over the horizon. And they come up with this plan. First plan is they want to kill him. The second plan is, hey, let's not kill him. Let's just at least teach him a lesson. And then they decided to get rid of him altogether. We've got a picture here, kind of an older style picture, to kind of understand what this scene may have looked like as we consider what's going on. How did Joseph react to this? I mean, here he is, favored by his father, walking, doing what his father asked him to do, go check on his brothers. He is his father's spy, after all, remember? And when they see the dreamer coming, man, they have had enough. They strip him of that favored coat, throw him into that dry well. We don't really know how Joseph reacts to this necessarily, but later in the story, we got to jump all the way to Genesis 42 to see this. We hear how Joseph responded through how the brothers were recalling this scene. See, years later, 7 years later, the brothers will be reunited with Joseph. And when they're experiencing this moment, what happens is they're recalling this very scene. And it's their words that tell us how Joseph responded when they say, "We saw his anguish when he pleaded for his life, but we wouldn't listen." It's their words. It's the brothers' words that condemn their own actions. Joseph is sitting there reaching back, pleading for his life. I had to wonder. I think often I kind of minimize the impact of this scene. But if you can really look at it, you can imagine Joseph screaming out to his brothers, "I'm so sorry for being the way that I was. I'm sorry about the dream. I'll stop. I won't act out like that anymore. Please don't let them take me. I won't be this way. I won't tell Dad what you're doing wrong all the time. I'll stop all of that. Please don't let them take me." I mean, can you imagine Joseph screaming and pleading for his life? He's promising change. He doesn't want to go. This is a powerful scene. And as he's pleading, I don't think he stopped. As the caravan pulls away and he's chained and he's being forced to walk this path, his voice keeps screaming back to his brothers, "Please don't let them take me. Please don't let them take me. Come on, guys, don't let them take me." And finally, they're far enough away you can't hear them anymore. Scene one ends with Joseph pleading for his life and his brothers giving each other high fives, saying, "What do you think of your dreams now, little man?" Have you ever had someone come to conclusions about you like this? Conclusions that maybe there's some truth to it. Quite honestly, maybe you were misbehaving. Maybe you were acting a little cocky. Maybe you were a little arrogant. Maybe things weren't quite right. But instead of them coming to you in love and saying, "Why don't you need to, can I help?" They decide they're going to plan your demise. Instead of being interested in helping, instead of being interested in really being a part of the solution, they decide it's best to get rid of you. And so you get kicked to the curb. Have you been there? Have you experienced that? I think all of us have to a certain degree. We've felt rejected in it. Man, there's no greater pain. There's no greater pain when others fail to protect us and look out for us. Powerful scene. Our next scene finds Joseph falsely accused at his new master's home, Potiphar. See, once Joseph got to Egypt, he was sold once again, and the name of his new master was Potiphar. Jewish traditions list that Potiphar could have likely been the chief of the cooking staff, but our scriptures say that he was the chief of the guard. So either way, he's in the upper echelon of the Pharaoh's personnel, and he's a very powerful man. Joseph was blessed by God. The reality is, Joseph, anything he touched, I think God did amazing things with. And so as Potiphar recognizes this, he begins to give Joseph more authority in his home. So eventually, Joseph is his personal attendant in charge of everything that Potiphar has. We've got a picture here to talk about where things go wrong. Potiphar's wife takes a liking to this young Joseph. And she is wanting Joseph to also take charge of her, if you know what I mean. This is one of those scenes where Joseph is trying to run from her, but can you imagine a 17-year-old boy, hormones a-raging, being offered what he's being offered? It takes a lot of courage to step away from that. Takes a lot of boldness to run away from his boss's wife. Now, I don't know if she just felt humiliated by the fact that he ran away from her. Maybe she thought that Joseph would give in if she threatened to throw him in jail. You know, you can never know the motives of the people who are accusing you of certain things. But for whatever reason, she claims that Joseph had attacked her. She believes, wants to sell this to her husband. "This man, this Hebrew that you brought into my house, tried to have his way with me." And so Potiphar's angry and throws Joseph into jail. He did nothing wrong. Now, when you step back and look at the difference between these two scenes, you've got one scene where the brothers are probably justified of being angry at Joseph at the very least, because they're seeing it for what it is. But in this scene, this is based on 100% deception. This is not how it went down. This is not at all built around truth. It's built on a bed of lies and deception. My question for you is this: has anyone falsely accused you of doing something you simply did not do? Even worse, was your accuser the one that was really at fault? And what they were trying to do was take the blame that they were going to feel, the shame that they were going to feel, and they're casting it onto you. Have you ever felt like you've been a pawn in their very intriguing chess game? Maybe Joseph could have ran, I don't know. We don't see him plead his case. We don't even see him being given the opportunity to do so. But what we do see is him thrown into jail, the bottom of the food chain, sitting next to men who have not shaved or showered for years. A damp, dark, smelly jail cell. He's shocked, confused. He's innocent, absolutely innocent, but he has been condemned. And that's where our second scene ends. Scene number three. Joseph is again blessed by God. And he's working in the jail. And the head jailer, the warden, understands that this man is trustworthy. And though he has no ability to free him, he can at least give him some responsibilities. And so Joseph begins to be a man who has a certain level of responsibilities right in his own jail. Kind of an interesting thing. See, in our jail system, if you're sentenced to something, you know how long you're going to be there. You're given a sentence. And if you act good, and if you're a good person, you might get out early. But you're going to at least serve this much time. That's the way our system works. But for the Egyptians, the system worked. You go to jail and you don't ask any questions. You might not ever come out of there. There is no sentence involved here. It's you go. And so Joseph may have thought, I'm going to spend the rest of my life here. I don't know what was running through his mind other than he knew to be faithful to God. He had been hopeless before, and he just remembered, I have to be faithful to God, and he was, and God began to see, give him favor. Well, here's a picture of two of his friends that he met in jail. Each of them had dreams. One of them was a baker for the Pharaoh. The other one was the cupbearer, or what we might call a butler today. He was a glorified food tester. His job was to test the food to make sure that it hadn't been laced with any kind of poison, probably from the baker, right? So here are these two men, and they have a dream, and they tell Joseph, who is now their friend, who is now over them in the jail, about their dream. And as Joseph begins to articulate what their dreams mean, he tells the baker that unfortunately your dream means that you're about to be executed. Sorry. He looks at the butler and says, but your dream says to me that you're going to be reinstated and things will be good for you. But look at what he says right after this. Genesis 40, beginning in 14. Please remember me, to the cupbearer, he says this. Please remember me and do me a favor when things go well for you. Mention me to Pharaoh so that he might let me out of this place. Now look at this. For I was kidnapped from my homeland, the land of the Hebrews. And now I'm here in prison, but I did nothing to deserve this. A closer look at this is that Joseph is still very much holding on to the moments that others have wounded him. He is very much holding on to, by that statement, that he's still pointing back to his homeland. He's still pointing back to the moment his brothers did this to him. And he's looking for his moment of justice. 3 days later, the interpretation of those two dreams happens. The baker is executed. The cupbearer is pulled from the cell and reinstated to get back to his job. But time passes and the cupbearer forgets about Joseph. He doesn't make good on that promise of helping him get out of jail. My question to you is this: have you ever had someone promise you something and then break that promise? Have you ever helped someone in the past and then when it was your turn kind of needing help, they weren't there for you? Someone ever tell you that they would do something for you and then completely drop the ball? You know, it's my guess that all of us have been let down by others. Multiple times, in fact, would be my guess. Our third and final scene ends with Joseph waiting. waiting in that jail cell. Now years later, he is now one of those men who hasn't cleaned up and shaved for years. It smells. He's waiting for his moment of justice. He's waiting to be used by God. He's waiting for that dream that he had when he was a young boy to happen. He's waiting for a friend to keep his promise. Waiting. Have you had the chance to identify with any of these scenes from Joseph's life today in your own life? It's my guess that each of us have. Can you see how others have continually let him down, wounded him? And how over time, he continues to be faithful to God, and yet in his faithfulness, he's still let down. He has still failed. He is still abused over and over and over again. I stopped at this point and asked myself, what did Jesus have to say about this? How would Jesus talk to Joseph if that were possible? And so I wanted to look at some scriptures with you today of what I think Jesus would say. We looked at one already as we read the Lord's Prayer together, and then Steve shared those words right after that. If you forgive others, I will forgive you. Those are powerful words that we need to understand that Jesus is saying here today. And as I continue to look at all these different scriptures of Jesus and words that Jesus said about how we need to respond when others hurt us, I began to remember and just be challenged once again how high the standard is of God expecting us to live a particular way. I think the church today as a whole is lowering the standard so we don't offend people. But quite frankly, people, and this is going to sound offensive, man, it is. The gospel is offensive. The gospel is hard. And I've read these words and go, my goodness, Lord, I don't know that I have that within me. It's so difficult. But he calls us to something bigger than ourselves. He calls us to pick up our cross and put our life on the back burner and live for him in radical ways. And so when we hear these words of Christ, that's the temperament we need to embrace them with. Let's listen to what he says in his very first sermon. I say to you, if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call someone an idiot, you're in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, well, you're in danger of the fires of hell. I mean, he's not talking about murdering people here. I mean, I've heard this so many times. You know, I'm a good person. I do good deeds. I work to help people out. I've never killed anybody, yada, 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 right? You know what Jesus said? Right before this passage he's talking about, you've heard it said, don't kill anybody. I'm telling you, don't even get mad at anybody. Don't even call someone an idiot. That is taking the standard that I think I can achieve. Don't murder anybody. I think I can achieve that. There are days. I got two teens in my house, you know. But then he takes that standard and shoots it off the roof and says, no, I'm telling you, don't even get mad at anybody. Don't call them an idiot. Raka is that word. Holy smokes, are you kidding me? This is tough stuff. This is challenging stuff. But he goes on. You might think, well, it's just his first sermon. Maybe he's made a mistake here. He's Jesus. Hang on a second. It gets better. You've heard the law says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. Listen to this. If you love only those who love you, he says, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you, God, hear these words, but you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Friends, this is hard. I've said it a number of times because I've preached it once already. I wrote it this week. I've rehearsed it. It's still hard. I'm looking at this going, I don't know. This is difficult stuff. I don't know if I can be perfect. What does he mean by this? I've actually stopped and wondered, does God really know what he's talking about when he's asking us to live like this? I mean, does he really know what it's like to be misunderstood? Does Jesus have a clue what it feels like to have the pain of rejection by those who once declared their love and commitment to you? Has he ever been told, we don't need your services anymore? Has he ever been falsely accused of doing something he didn't do? Wait a minute. I baited you into that one, sorry. This is Jesus. Absolutely, he has felt the pain of being misunderstood. Absolutely, he has felt the pain of rejection. Absolutely, he has been told, we don't need you anymore. You're not servicing my needs anymore. Yes, he's been falsely accused. Absolutely, he knows. And yet this is what he tells us. In Matthew 18, Peter came to him and asked, Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me? Seven times, he questions. Jesus' response, no, not seven times, Peter, but 70 times seven. Some of your translations may say 77 times. I don't care if it's 490 or 77. Jesus has a point that he's making here. The common cultural thinking and understanding of the day was you only had to forgive someone three times. So on the fourth time, you didn't have to anymore. Well, that's pretty liberating, isn't it? So what you do, you'd keep track of all the times that someone's wounded you, hurt you, and you'd forgive them those three times, and then you'd say, fourth time, sorry, I get to hate you the rest of your life. I seriously have no idea if that's how it went. I mean, I don't know, but I do know, culturally speaking, there was a number associated with the amount of times you had to forgive someone who sinned against you. And so Peter, being the overachiever, doubles it and adds one. How about seven times, Jesus? If I do it seven times, aren't I awesome? Not even close, Peter. Not even close. Because what I'm telling you, Peter, is there's no end to the amount of grace and forgiveness I'm willing to extend, and so there is no end to the amount of grace and forgiveness you need to extend. No end. Forgiving has this element of release that I think that we miss quite often. When we look at the end of Joseph's story, not tomorrow, you can't come back tomorrow, we won't be here. But when we look at it next Sunday, you're going to begin to see how Joseph releases some of this pain. You remember how he felt when he spoke to the cupbearer and he pointed back to all the wrongs that he had felt and he went back all the way back to his homeland. He was still holding on to so much of that hurt. But when we see the end of this story, we're going to see a different Joseph, a Joseph that has released, a Joseph who has forgiven and who has let go of that pain. There's a glimpse of it in chapter 50, verse 20, and it won't be on your screen, but the brothers are terrified because their father, Jacob, has died, and now they think, that was the only thing keeping us alive. Joseph can kill us now. And so they're very nervous about this, and it breaks Joseph's heart that they would be terrified about that. And he says these words to them, you intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. That's a statement that's not holding on to the past. That's a statement that has embraced freedom. This is a powerful statement that you need to hear today. Forgiveness is setting a prisoner free, only to discover that that prisoner was you. See, we think forgiveness is about setting the person who wronged us free, and that really is not something we're interested in because we want them to pay the price, right? Come on. It's true. If we forgive them, they get by with hurting me, and I'm not interested in that. Mm-hmm. Come on, somebody. Be bold. Admit it. What we fail to see is that in our lack of forgiveness, we're the ones chained up. We're the ones who are being held captive. We're the ones whose life is being wasted away because we're not releasing that guilt. We're not releasing what we want them to have, which is to pay the price of hurting me. And so what too often happens is we hurt, and we never forgive, and it gets escalated, and nobody gets along. And then you start coming to church with people you don't even want to talk to. You have to go to work and talk, you know, not talk to people. You can't do anything about it. You need a check, right? There's nothing you can do about people that hurt you there. Your boss wounds you, so what? You got to suck that one up. There's nothing you can do about it. But you got a choice where you want to worship. You got a choice where you want to shop. You got a choice where you want to, you know, live. You got a choice whether you go to that family reunion. You got a choice if you want to send a Mother's Day card. You got a choice if you want to recognize a birthday. See how the separation, it just goes off like this, and there's no healing, and you're the one captive. You're the one thinking about it, not them. We don't need to be captive. Jesus has paved a way so that you don't have to be a prisoner of the people who have wounded you. And friends, I've wounded you. You're sitting here going, boy, I hope you practice what you preach. And I want to, desperately. I went to Indiana this weekend practicing what this is. Because there's difficulty there for me. And yet I knew I had to make a choice. And so I'm telling you, it's hard. It's not easy. But we got to do this. We got to forgive. We've got to let go. And here's the beauty of some of this, the coolness of some of this, is that when we do, when we participate in forgiving others, we are participating in our own miracle of forgiveness. Because what Jesus said is, when you forgive others, then I'm capable of forgiving you. And if you hold on to it, then guess what? I can't. I won't. You participate in your own miracle of grace, your own miracle of redemption, your own miracle of forgiveness when you practice forgiving others. Consider this. I mean, seriously, think about this in the life of Joseph. If Joseph's brothers had never sold him, then he would have never gone to Egypt. If he would have never gone to Egypt, he would have never been sold to Potiphar. If he would have never been sold to Potiphar, then he would have never been put into prison. If he never would have been put into prison, he would have never been able to eventually interpret the Pharaoh's dreams, and then he would have never become powerful in the land of Egypt. If he would have never had any of that happen, his people would have died in a famine. All of those bad things took place because God was working and developing him, and he was able to forgive and move forward throughout his life. Friends, no one is exempt from being hurt. I've got bad news for you. Okay? None of us are exempt from being hurt. Not even the sinless Son of God himself. And I know that there are extreme situations out there where you have been wounded very, very deeply. But I want to believe that in most scenarios, pain is often a vehicle to experience life transformation. And parents, you believe it, because when you want your kids to act differently, we inflict a little pain. True? Not a lot, just enough to get somebody's attention. Right? Pain is often a vehicle of personal life transformation. So the question I have for you at the conclusion of our time together is this. Will you be transformed by the pain and be held captive by the pain? Or will you be transformed into freedom and experience a life that becomes more like Christ? Prisoner, Christ. Pain, freedom. The choice is ours. The choice is yours. The choice is mine. I want us, I want me to live a life of freedom. I want to live a life of freedom. I don't want to be bound by the hurts and the pains of other people in my life. To do so would mean somehow that I should feel like exempt from being hurt. And I know we're all not exempt from that. We are going to be wounded. And like I said, I know that I wound others. So our job as believers is not to condemn all of that probably, but to find ways, healthy ways. And again, there are extreme situations where some help is going to be required in this, but we need to find ways to be people who forgive And not just with our lips, but we forgive by releasing. Doesn't mean we have to go back to that well and get beat up again. There's something about boundaries we all need to understand. And it's a very complex topic, and I'm having to get it done, right? But I'm not talking about being repeatedly abused. That's not what God wants. But He does look for us to be people of forgiveness, people of release, people of freedom, not people of bondage. Would you stand with me? We're not going to sing. We're not going to do anything. I'm going to pray for you. And then I want us to say a prayer together. Can I pray though? Father, such a difficult topic today, because I know many stories here today. I know some of the pain, but I know just a fraction. Many are here today who have been replaying in their minds moments where they have been wounded very, very deeply. And God, I know it's difficult to forgive, and it feels like they win when we release. But you call us to be people who aren't bound by that pain, but people rather who experience a sense of freedom and wholeness and life that comes from you. I can't understand each circumstance, and I can't speak to each of them today, but what I do know is this: your Spirit can. And it is my prayer as we conclude our time together that you will speak into each heart and begin that healing process. And it is a process of helping them forgive, helping them to release, and helping them find wholeness again. I know that your Spirit is capable of doing that. My words are not. So, Holy Spirit, work in our lives and challenge us, I pray. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Additional downloads and resources are available by visiting flushingcommunity.org. Join us this Sunday as we gather to experience God's transforming love together.